So the problem is all these have, they're sitting on big paper losses, right? Capital losses on all the bonds they bought that are supposed to be safe. And looking to recapitalize themselves and looking to fill that hole in their balance sheet. And the regulators are like, go ahead.
Heath Weiner, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Andy. How about you?
Doing good. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm quite the admirer from afar from your work and your discussions. And what I really want to pick your, well, there's a lot of things I want to pick your brain about, but let's start out just the general macro view of the economy, where we're at and where we're going. What are your thoughts?
You know, the backdrop to all of this, to really understand this, that live in a very unnatural and artificial regime, which is the regime of irredeemable currency. And, you know, for the first time, the whole world has gone mad, has gone all in on this, you know, scheme. And, you know, you have a couple of problems with irredeemable currency. The interest rate is unstable. You know, it skyrocketed through the 1970s up to about 1981. It was basically falling ever since. I argue that all the drivers for why it's falling are continuing to fall. I'm sorry, continuing to be in full force and effect. It will continue to fall, notwithstanding the attempt to fight the tide. And the reason is, you know, you can't pay off a debt. Debt currency debt. So if you pay off a debt, you're just shifting it around. So all the debt accumulates. And the professor I studied under, a guy named Fekete, the analogy of imagine if you threw the garbage in the attic and every day, you know, you'd open the hatch to try to put more garbage in there. Well, eventually it all comes down on you. And those are the little crises we have. But in the meantime, just the weight of all that bearing down, it just becomes heavier and heavier and heavier. I wrote an article called The Economic or The Heat Death of the Economic Universe, talking about the diminished everything about what we're diminishing. That is the same box. The same additional buck that's borrowed at the margin produces a diminishing effect of adding GDP to the economy. And of course, once there, the interest on it has to be serviced forever. And so it adds, you know, less and less boost, which is a one-shot boost. And that just drags, just adds its weight to all the rest of the anchors dragging on everything. So, you know, everything just becomes more and more frictional, more and more lethargic. And so the debt has to grow exponentially in order to keep any semblance of, you know, or pretense, I should say, of economic normalcy. And that's the world that we're in. And every time the government makes business harder, I don't know, by, let's say, locking everybody down, destroying supply chains, destroying whole industries, whole swathes of the economy. And then just as we're recovering, you know, from that, you know, first of all, there's a whiplash effect, but then governments around the world imposing green energy restrictions and then tariffs and not just tariffs, but trade war. You know, if you're in the semiconductor industry, you'd have to be terrified to have any part of your supply chain going to Asia right now. So that's a massive, you know, frictional force for those guys to have to recreate all the capacity they have in Asia all over again in the US. Onshoring or nearshoring, obviously, a lot of it goes to Mexico. Enormous amounts of capital diverted from something else that could be additive to the economy to simply replace, you know, that which already exists. And
Right.
that's the backdrop, right? So everything about it, deployment can go up or down, stock market can go up or down. All of that has to be understood in this context, that it's not, as the Keynesians say, and I think most people sort of accept today, well, the stock market goes up and GDP goes up, you know, based on animal spirit. You know, if people feel good, everyone's like, I should shut up talking about inflation because they're going to trigger inflation. Talk doesn't trigger this. It's not about feelings. It's not about sentiment. It's about real things that are going on. Everybody always wants to make more money. Everybody always wants to consume more. But there's times when credit is easily flowing and everybody and everything is dependent on not just credit, but every increasing amount of increasing credit. And when that's flowing freely and accelerating freely, you know, you got what passes for growth nowadays. And when that, then you know, terrible thing, you know, happen, and then the Fed will, and you know, interest rates will be slammed back down to zero much faster than they were hiked.
I like how you brought that back all the round full circle, because I think this is very dependent. When I mean this, the economy, you can say GDP, you can even say the world economy, really, and what we live on is really interest rate sensitive or driven by interest rates. And you're in this camp that is very interest rates more than likely have peaked, even the long-term yields have peaked. Am I saying that correct?
Yeah, I mean, look at the 10-year treasury. For all this talk of maybe we'll hike them more and whatever, you know, we've seen, did we see 4.6? I know we saw 4.5 something. We're now 4.2.
Yeah.
You know, people say, oh, well, the bond market, conflicting with the stock market, the bond market is right. Not that people on the bond market are expressing, they're not stock market speculators. They're not making a bet. It's not like the bears versus the bulls and who's right. That what's driving the world is credit. And you see, you know, everybody should be excited when they find an indicator that's, you know, much more difficult to manipulate. Though, I mean, the short-term interest.
You made me laugh. You're right. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, so imagine a perverse game where every time there's an indication, let's say that one team is winning, you know, they change the rules. And they remove that from the, you know, let's say it's baseball and, you know, one team is scoring more runs. So they just take runs off the scoreboard. And it's not about runs anymore. And so you just can't see it, right? So right. That dictates the overnight rate. That's administered by the central planners. And I make enemies when I say central planning.
I like the way you say central planners. I would agree.
Yeah. You know, some folks would argue, wrongfully, I would add, but they would argue that, well, so central planning, if you go into each individual industry and each individual company and pick individual winners and losers, Microsoft is going to win, Google is going to lose, that's central planning. But what the Fed is doing, you think that's not just central planning, that's, you know, whatever market monetarism or whatever the hell term they want to coin for it at the moment. Central planning, right? The bureaucrats sit around and decide what the rate should be.
Right.
And every while when something comes out about how that process occurs, it reminds me of I think it was an Atlas Shrugged where Ayn Rand said this, that a person expected to find this evil giant, you know, that was behind the whole thing. And when he got there, you know, there was like a fog. And then when he got through the fog, it was a nest of roaches scurrying, you know, for you know, away from the light. You know, whenever any kind of sunlight penetrates how these people are making these decisions, it's a little better than numerology, astrology, sheep entrails, eye of newt. I mean, it's really, really pathetic. Hunches, yeah. Kinds of things. And which everybody is forced to be Kremlin watchers. I remember under Greenspan.
That's so true.
When you go to the meeting and he carried this briefcase, which was one of those old leather satchel. And he didn't have a lot of papers in there. And everyone knew that his habit was, if there was going to be a change in interest rate, he'd bring the document that would prove his point. And if he didn't bring any documents or didn't bring a lot of documents, then he wasn't going to try to change. So the people, you know, like paparazzi, or like, you know, when Chevrolet is rumored to have a new Corvette, all these guys are out there with a, you know, big telephoto lenses trying to get a glimpse, and they disguise the car and camouflage and all that. You know, they're out there to get a shot of his briefcase on his way to the meeting. And, what was behind it all is a bunch of rubbish, because these guys don't know what the right interest rate is. They just know what the right interest rate is, but they make it up and they administer it. So the point is, you can't look at the overnight funds rate as an indicator of anything, because completely they've replaced the signal with, you know, somebody just pressing a button or turning a knob. But when you look at the longer term rate, the Fed has a lot of influence on longer term rates. But it's kind of counterintuitive, and it's not a nice linear direct, you know, relationship. Like, oh, they're buying bonds, and therefore bond prices go up. That's not true.
Right.
The Fed was bonds the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, and rates were going up, bond prices were going down. So anyway, I mean, you look at the price of the 10-year treasury going up in the face of all this, i.e. the interest rate going down, and that's, and, you know, so we have this massively inverted yield curve. You know, what is that saying? That's saying there's something wrong in the economy.
Right.
You know, people turn it into you know, tarot card kind of thing. Well, if the yield curve is inverted, that doesn't mean anything by itself. But when it uninverts, then that's the harbinger of inflation, blah, 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 blah. They kind of reverse the cart and the horse. That, yeah, the reason why it uninverts, because finally the Fed panics. The Fed sees something going wrong in the economy they care about. By the way, they don't care if you have a job or not. And they don't care if the prices are going up the grocery store. It's all, charade or pretext or whatever, you know, window dressing, whatever term you want to put on that. But they do care about the solvency of the banks. So when the third wall's coming and whatever, then they react and slam the interest rate to zero. But of course, it's always too late. And so, harbinger of recession, right? But it's not the own inversion that caused, or even really early the signal, you know, the final effect of when the Fed is slamming rates to zero, you get the uninversion. Because now the short end of the curve goes to zero, the long end of the curve is 4%, gets uninverted, right? You know, what to do? That's just a mechanical thing. But what is causing the Fed to do that? Damage is finally penetrating through the wall of the ivory tower, penetrating through its heads, and they finally realize, oh, beep, you know, something's going on here that we better, you know, better address.
Got it. Let's talk about that. So I want to lean on the yield curve there. And you just mentioned banks. Something happens when the banks are insolvent. Or what you just said is that the Fed doesn't really, a lot of us, they don't care about what, but what they do care about is bank solvency or insolvency, if you would. And my question is, how are banks then making any money with the yield curve that's been inverted? I want to say for about, if my memory serves me correctly, it's over 12 months. It's been over 12 months. I want to say, yeah, roll right at 12 months. How are they making any money? And my second question is, how does this affect corporate debt? Because that must put a lot of strain on corporate debt. Correct me if I'm wrong.
So we did on our podcast, we did a show called, or a series of shows called Zombie Month for October, in honor of Halloween, but also in honor of
Halloween.
You know, so Zombie is a company whose profits are less than its interest. In other words, it can't even afford, forget repaying the debt. It can't even afford to service it. It can't even pay the, and you know, before interest rates were going up, the data that was coming out of the Bank for International Settlements, the other source, pegged at around 20% of all corporate debt was zombie debt.
20%.
Nothing. Now, that was when the Fed funds rate was essentially zero, and then they raised it to essentially 5.5. And so, at that time, if a zombie was able to borrow at 3%, now they're borrowing at 8.5 or something. How many more companies at this interest rate are zombie, or rendered zombie by, you know, simply raising the bar that much, you know, versus then? Well, I haven't seen any new data come out yet, sort of post interest rate hikes. I guess the data is probably due soon. Then we'll see what it looks like. But you'd have to think there's that, you know, essentially they've moved the margin, and zombies are the ones that are beneath the margin. You've moved the margin up 5.5%. That's a big deal, and there's a lot more companies. When companies have to roll, you know, they may find they can't. The market doesn't want to lend them anymore. Or if they can, they're really going to pay, you know, obviously the market interest rate, which is a lot higher now. And that higher interest rate itself is going to contribute further to their zombification and, ultimately demand.
Yeah.
You're right when you said have the banks make money. Banks, in this regime, it's not normal for banks, but I think this regime is normal, exists to borrow short to lend long. And, when you're borrowing short at 5.5 and lending long at 4.5, it's a problem. And then on top of that, the banks, because they were encouraged all during, let's say 2020 and 2021, they're encouraged to load up on treasury bonds at record high price, i.e. record low interest rate. To make sure everybody watching this understands, the interest rate and the bond price are saw. They're strict mathematical inverse. Interest rates rising means bond price falling in direct reverse. So since peak price of the 10-year treasury in mid-summer 2020, that bond fell about 25% in market value. So imagine you buy shares of some company at 100 and it goes down to 75.
Yeah.
That's kind of a big deal. especially if you borrowed 99 in order to buy that thing at 100, and then it goes down to 75. So then your balance sheet now is minus 24. So then the banks say, okay, well, no problem. I put that in scare quotes. 2008 crisis, banks don't have to mark their assets to market anymore. So you can take that thing that's worth 75 and you can keep it on your books at 100 and pretend it's worth 100, which is what, I don't know, Silicon Valley Bank was doing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, baby boomer Griffin, which I just think is so iconic of that generation. I'm not a baby boomer. I'm a proud member of Gen X.
Me too.
For anybody who cares. But, you know, the expression is not a problem until it's a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of the philosophy of an ostrich, I suppose. It's there with its head buried beneath the sand, and it's not a problem until somebody comes along and kicks it, then you know what? Then it's a problem. You know, you can write on your books anything you want. Paper does not refute the aim. But it's not true. In fact, the reality is you're actually insolvent and you're otherwise. So, you know, the difference, and I saw this on a few interviews I've done recently, the Fed today, the Powell Fed, would say that the Bernanke 2008 Fed would leap at the helm. They were negligent, they were stupid, they were not stupid, but they were slow, they were not proactive, and they allowed all this stuff to happen. Well, one thing on that, the other thing is that there was some semblance of rules that the Fed had to go through. That's it, but, you know, rules have been kicked to the curb and thrown out the window. You know, the Fed, by comparison, is like hyper proactive. That, you know, the Fed is just jumping on top of every little thing before it becomes. And so I like to talk about the spread between junk bonds and treasuries.
Yes, please.
The overall interest rate trend is one thing, but if you can change between two different credit instruments, that makes more information than the interest rate trend itself. So we all know interest rates are going up. Okay, fine. Some economists say that's going to be the end of the world. Other economists say it's fine. You know, it's not a problem. MMT, modern monetary theory, people are saying, well, that's just a subsidy for rich people. Like, they totally don't get, you know, anything if it's not written in Marx or Mothler, you know, not in their comments, and they don't get it. But, you know, that interest rate expense has gone way, way up for everybody. But you should see a difference between junk bonds and treasury bonds. Oh, one other thing I want to say. There's a lot of people in the gold and alternative investing communities pointing to the Fed's, or the treasuries, the federal government's, you know, rising interest rate payment obligation. They look at this, you know, the government's going to crash, it's going to default. All the, and they're literally the last entity in the world to default. That is, every other entity in the world will default first. All 50 state governments, all the foreign government, all the banks, all the foreign banks, all the domestic corporations, all the foreign corporations, all the homeowners, all the car buyers, all the student loans, all the credit cards, all the, you know, small business debt, that's all headed to default long before the federal government actually default. They're the guys with the printing press.
Right.
Everyone laughed to their manager. So, so there's the spreads, junk rated credits, you know, pay more, pay a higher interest rate than the U.S. government, obviously. So you can look at the spread between the two. And, the spread right now just simply hasn't really moved. I mean, you know, during COVID, when everyone thought, oh my God, these companies are headed to default, before all the bailout and the stimulus and everything else, spread was about 10 percentage points. That is, they were paying 10 percentage points more interest rate versus the federal government. You know, the peak of the crisis, that it hit around 20. 3.2 right now, literally saying nothing. Now, I don't think that's because there's no stress for junk credit. I think they're all really struggling. But I think because somebody has found a way to, shall we say, put their thumb on the scales. And, you know, I've talked about this a few times. I think, among other things, I don't know if the Fed is actually buying any of
I was going to ask that.
Giving themselves the power to do something. Discussions to whether they are or aren't at the moment. But, you know, a friend of mine that I golf with, I try to do it as often as possible with like 3 or 4 times a year. You know, he and I, every time we got together for golf, he's like, so what's the answer to the dilemma? Why the spread not widening? Why is it not blowing out? And every time we get together, like on the first tee shot, it's like, you know, I'd go hit my ball or miss, kick maybe, or whatever, it's off of the trees. And so what's the answer to that dilemma? Which we both knew what the context was because we were so obsessed with it. Then I got together with him about a year ago, September, coming back from a little trip. We finally got out on the golf course, and I think I have the answer. So he's in the investment advisory business, sells a lot of annuities and insurance products. And I was talking with the back office folks, including compliance officer and one annuity provider, a big insurance carrier. And they said that the regulators have given them the green light to load up on this stuff without having to reserve the capital that they normally would. Like if you're a pension or an annuity, you want to load up on a treasury bond, you don't have to reserve a lot of capital against that because they're guaranteed to pay it in nominal terms. But of course, your liabilities are in nominal terms also, so you're fine, you're hedged. You know, you want to buy something with a higher yield, you know, that then you have to reserve capital for it. So the problem is all these they're sitting on big paper losses, right? Capital losses on all the bonds they bought that are supposed to be safe. And they're looking to recapitalize themselves. They're looking to fill that hole in their balance sheet. And the regulators are like, go ahead. It's another 3% point to buy that junk stuff. And we will be aggressively indifferent to you choosing to do this time. And that's his theory. And the more that I think about it, you know, it has to go to market to go buy the paper and not just, if they're the sole buyer, then everyone else is a seller. And, you know, the optics of that look bad and ultimately overrun. You know, unless they want to grow their balance sheet a lot more than I think they do. But if you get everyone else, you believe it. And, you know, you get the regulators that are on it, so the insurance and annuity regulators. You know, winking and saying, you know, go for it. The Fed, and there's an implied guarantee. Look, if you need to sell them, the Fed will buy it all. But, you know, whoever they've managed it or finished it, I think part of the solution has gotten, found private market participants or natural buyers with the right amount, you know, shall we say, government incentive.
Well, that sounds to me like quantitative easing really on steroids. Because it's not only the Fed buying debt, not only the Fed buying junk debt, it's the private sector with the backing of the Fed buying debt and buying junk debt. So that's probably where we see, I went and ate a hamburger for Father's Day. It cost me $20. Hey, hamburger. When pre-COVID, it was less than 10, pretty easy. That's where you get that right.
I don't think that the cause of rising prices, pension fund swap their treasury bond for junk bonds. Like that's me. You know, if you were to give every consumer, especially the kind of people that don't save any money, go to, let's say, the bottom 50% of the population who have essentially no saving, whatever they make, spend 110% of it because they'll lever it up with credit card, and you airlift little dollar bill to put them there and so go spend everything. But the way quantitative easing works is the bank, and then the Fed says, we're going to buy that asset off of you. And now, so instead of the bank having $1 billion worth of treasury bond, now the bank has $1 billion worth of Fed reserves.
Right. Got it.
Not go and dole out. First of all, you can't. Fed reserves actually aren't even spendable anyway. Different bucket of what we call money, credit, and not fundable with any other credit in the economy anyway. Even living that aside, the last thing the bank's going to go do is spend a balance sheet. When the Fed buys that particular asset off of them, the bank turns around and buys another asset. That's what they have to do. They're concerned about Earth and everything above what they don't want to preserve, they buy something else. And the net result is asset price is rising. And everyone, including the bank, profits from rising prices. Can take some of that gain and spend it. But not the massive force for rising prices, you know, people assume it to be. But what it is in this case is a massive force for delaying of the next crisis. And I said, delaying, I mean, you can't really prevent it, but the longer you bottle it up, the more pressure builds, and eventually it becomes a question. And, you know, question of, I mean.
Yeah. So then my question would be to leading all of this would be, why is the dollar still so strong relative to everything else? Because the ECB just announced an easing, if you would, or a bias just, 2 weeks ago or a week ago? So is it just the reason that the Fed is just in a better position? Or, why isn't the dollar tanking?
One argument, the dollar is the least dirty shirt. And that's true enough. I mean, whatever problems people talk about with the U.S. dollar, in part, biggest currency, so got the most commentary about it. And also, it's the most transparent. The central banks in the world are a lot less transparent about what they're doing with the other government. I mean, you can't really trust any data coming out of China, for example. But that's not the main thing. The main thing is all the other currencies are dollar derivatives. There's not the dollar and other currencies. There's the dollar and then there's local paper scrip. What a coal mining town would have had in West Virginia in the 19th century. They don't compete against the dollar. They derive their value from the dollar. So in my view, de-dollarization is when all the dollar juice is sucked out of them. And then, you know, when the Zimbabwe dollar finally de-dollarized, it was worthless and it was discarded. I actually regret, I was at I think it was Freedom Fest 2009, and there was some booth that was giving away the 100 quadrillion Zimbabwe dollar notes, which are, you know, real currency in Zimbabwe at the end. I got it and I put it in my goody bag and I was like, you know what, this is garbage. I threw it out with the rest of my, you know, stuff in the hotel room. Now those things are selling for 20, 30 bucks on eBay as commemorative. I was like, oh, man, I still kept that little piece of history. But, you know, the other currencies are really going down against the dollar because partly they're lower quality, but partly when, you know, credit conditions tighten, the most stress is felt at the margin. And the margin is going to be in the other economies that aren't officially dollarized. But the dollar still drives the world economy. And so, you know, every major producer, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in Asia, whether you're in, you know, the Middle East or whatever, has borrowed dollars. So if you want to know what really keeps the value of the dollar up, every producer owes them. And when you owe, you know, dollars, you have to do something. You have to produce enough to dump that stuff on the market to raise enough dollars that net of all your expenses, which, remember, costs are going up faster than revenues. Net of all your expenses, you have enough dollars left over to service your debt.
Right.
If you don't have dollars, then you default, and then there are consequences to defaulting. Even if you're too big for the bank to, you know, foreclose on you, you're a sovereign or whatever, you know, your access to credit dries up, and you know, you're really in a bad way. And everybody from, you know, domestic American, you know, producers to, you know, foreign producers, foreign governments, everybody in between are scrambling to get dollars. The Fed has made dollars much more dear in this 5.5% interest rate environment. And so the scramble for dollars, it's not that anybody wants the dollar to go up or anybody thinks it's going to go up or thinks it should go up. It's just that's what happens as a consequence of making dollars harder to get, is people bid on them.
Right.
Income in euros, but it doesn't take euros to service that debt. It takes dollars. Dump the euro, buy the dollar, service the debt. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very perverse world.
Yeah.
Work the way, you know, quote unquote, ought to.
Yeah. No, that's well said. I just kind of straddle the fence when it comes to de-dollarization or or I should say dollarization. It's just at the end of the day, though, I just think, what then? Because the whole system is based on dollars. And so to de-dollarize, the whole system would have to change. And I'm not sure. I mean, maybe eventually, but this moment right now, I think that's too monumental. If you think, I just think it's too monumental.
Examples of an entire global system changing overnight. All right. That's how, you know, social things work. You know, the term that economists would use for this is network effect. The dollar has cemented the network effect, and no paper currency can, and you're not going to really close. And if you know Jeff Snyder, I had him on my podcast, we were talking about, and I said, well, the currency is a dollar derivative, and so on. And he said, you know, a percentage. So there's about not quite a quadrillion dollars approaching that of derivatives.
I can't even think about that high. Yeah.
It's a stupefying number, literally. So he said, you know, a percentage of derivative contracts have the dollar on at least one side. I said, well, it was 90%. So basically, there's the dollar, and that's it, full stop. There isn't really anything else that, you know, even in the same room.
Yeah.
And only one thing can replace the dollar, and that's gold.
Yeah.
And that nobody, I mean, even half the gold bugs are kind of the free gold, you know, view. They don't really want gold circulating money at a monetary system. They want a paper currency where gold is going up in terms.
Right.
You get profits, right? You buy gold, it goes up, and you sell it, and you have more consumer goods. But nobody on either the left or the right or the center, the so-called market monetarist, anybody else in mainstream economics wants anything to do with any kind of gold standard. You know, the number of people that want a gold standard, let alone that they agree on what that gold standard would be, but the number of people that want a gold standard, a rounding error, zero. In fact, we're a tiny little ragtag group of us. And so are we going to have a gold standard? Well, monetary metals, the whole business is that if you pay interest on gold, gold will come to market. And it's working. So if we can scale it up, then, and we are scaling right now. We've equity capital, we've raised debt capital, we issued our own gold bond. We have a 12% silver bond right now to finance a miner. It's open right now for anybody. And we're paying interest. We pull the metal into the market. So in the case of silver, as you can imagine, a lot of people have closets somewhere in their house or their basement where the silver bars are stacked up. Silver is very bulky. Not only is it valuable than gold, it's twice much bulk for the same mass. And then, 80 something to one in terms of volume, which means it's 100 times the bulk of gold value. So what you could have in a gold bar, you know, big, you know, could be a small closet full of silver. And what we're seeing is people are mobilizing silver and sending it in order to participate in silver bond, 12%.
Right.
And so everybody, you know, wants absolute safety and everything else, but at the same time, they want a return. And if you're offering a return, then it's what makes the world go around. So if we can scale this up, I think a good working definition of a gold standard, not a formal definition, but is when anybody wants to can deposit their metal and earn interest on their metal then, and therefore that's when we scale up, because that's exactly what we're
doing. So it doesn't really have to be official.
Yeah, in fact, better off than anything.
Yeah.
The last three, even in places where the gold standard, even government always has some, involves some intrusion in money market. Even in places where the competent administrators, there was distortion that came about of that, and ultimately those distortions led to, you know, complaints and problems. Like, so those problems with always more government intrusion, until eventually it became so untenable that for most of the world they just wanted to abandon gold when the eve of World War I clung on for another 20 years. But and ultimately effectively abandoned that in 1903. You know, the final nail finally coming 40 later. It really should be a bottom-up entrepreneurial free market. And all you really need is the rule of law.
Yeah.
Give me my middle on a right to get. If you won't get back, well, I have a right back, and I have a recourse to court, including ultimately judgment. You know, want judgment. You know, you're involuntarily forcing thievership.
Yeah.
Right? Liquidate whatever you have to look, pay me. Once I'm paid, you know, I go away. If you have the rule of law, which we largely do, you know, people complain about how bad the West, I think, time in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Whether it be India, you know, Central Asia, whatever, let alone Russia, let alone China, still largely have the rule of law.
Yeah. You know,
and you can go to court, and, you know, if you have a clear contract, and the contract has been well, you know, because the contract itself is violating the rule of law, you know, violating the law somewhere, contracts are enforceable. And that comes from bottom up. You know, standard. One interesting thing about the silver bond, right? So we did the first gold bond, I believe, in 8 something years. This was in 2020. And there was no gold bond after 1933 when Roosevelt broke the gold. Legal possessed gold. He avoided all the gold clauses, including on the bond. I spoke at the Harvard Club in New York. They have all the memorabilia hanging on the walls. And one of the things that caught my eye was bond from a railroad circa 1900. I have a picture of it. And then later, you know, zooming in, God bless the camera. Smartphones, the resolution was such, you could zoom all the way in to see all the print on the, you know, fancy script on the front. 3.5% interest, 90 years maturity. Said payable in the language, the standard gold coin, you know, legal tender gold coin, which is pretty, you know, coin at the time. And of course, in 1933, Roosevelt broke and said, now payable in, you know, irredeemable government dollars. And, you know, so there's an irony to it. Of course, Harvard is one of the schools that taught that we shouldn't have a gold standard. And so, with their capital, that, you know, that's about the time they were repaid the principal in the 1990s, you know, it had been absolutely something.
Right.
Anyways, silver was effectively demonetized in 1834 by the coinage act. Still coined silver, but it undervalued silver's coin. If you had, you know, $1.03 worth of silver, why would you bring it rent to get a $1 coin out of it? You're better off getting, you know, especially if you had a lot of it, you'd ship it to the world market. It's worth $1.03. So, it was a gold standard, even though I meddled officially for another, 40 years. It was effectively a gold standard. And so after that time, banks would, we had gold and not silver. And what the banks, what the lending would have been, and the bonds would have been gold. And now we're doing silver bonds. I think the first silver bond in 90 years.
That's awesome.
A historic moment. All we need to do is more of them.
Yeah.
And recreate this, you know, barbarous relic monetary standard without it being the official, you know, standard, without any government intrusion in it. Well, I think we've moved the needle of the world one pixel so far. And start at, we're flushed up the calf, you got a war chest. We're, you know, going more aggressively to the market now. And, you know, we got a lot more bonds coming, got a lot more leases coming. We can change the thing. Crazy as food bristic sounds.
No, it sounds like a great goal for me. So Keith, let's end on that. Let's tell us, I'm a big fan of your work, not only your talks, but what you're doing. How can people reach out to you? They want to do business with you. They want to purchase gold bonds or silver bonds or anything like that.
Come to our website, which is monetary-metals.com. On Twitter, I'm at Real Keith Wiener.
And you respond. You responded to me. Oh, thank you for that.
I tried to. I can't wait to have the message. Up and I gotta grueling travel schedule. We try.
You do have a busy travel schedule, but I want to thank you so much for making the time for me and for my listeners. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that tune in. You're a great name. But yeah, just thank you for spending the time with me.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you.